You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
My name's Natalie Nichols. I'm the director of RSA Global. And it's my very delight to welcome you to this event today. Happy General Election Day as well. The RSA is interested in how social change organisations like ourselves make a legitimate and meaningful impact in the 21st century. In partnership with an organisation called Kivu International and the Think Tank Initiative, we recently published a discussion paper on the role that think tanks in developing countries can have to support social change, and found that they really need to have a sense of political nous and a great dollop of innovation. So it was within this context that we are delighted to invite one of the world's most prolific thinkers to help us to understand how change happens in our ever unpredictable world. Duncan Green is a senior strategic advisor at Oxfam GP and one of the world's leading experts on social change. He's the author of How Change Happens and From Poverty to Power, How Active Citizens and Effective States Can Change the World. He also has a very successful blog, also called Poverty to Power. Duncan was previously senior policy advisor on trade and development at the Department for International Development and a policy analyst on trade and globalisation at CAFOD, the Catholic International Development NGO. He's currently a professor in practice at the London School of Economics and a visiting fellow at the Institute of Development Studies at the University of Sussex. Over to you, Duncan. We're listening to what you have to say.
Thank you. So How Change Happens is one of those big titles which is academic suicide if you want to be an academic, because you're making ridiculously over-claiming statements about how change happens. But the joy about working for Oxfam is I've given the space to stand back and just look at patterns that emerge from our work. And over the last few years, this topic of change as a thing in itself, rather than looking at a particular project or a particular sort of social movement, has become more and more sort of salient and turned into the book. So I was trying to work out when did I start to think about change as a thing in itself. And I sort of went back to about 2006, where I went to visit this community in India, a fishing community, and I started to get very excited about systems and processes and rediscovering my undergraduate physics roots about how these processes work. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about this community. It's in a place called Tikamgar, which is an overnight train ride from Delhi in Madhya Pradesh. And it's a traditional community of fishing people. There's no politically correct word for this. Who've been there for hundreds of years fishing traditional artificial lakes. And those lakes produced a small amount of fish, enough for these people to survive. Their lower caste, which in India is a kind of all-defining state of identity, so they're at the bottom of the social pyramid. About 30 years ago, someone discovered that you could massively increase the productivity of these lakes by putting in fish eggs, sowing them, you know, cultivating them in a sort of more traditional, in what is now a traditional aquaculture way. Absolute disaster. Because the first thing that happened once the productivity went up was that upper caste group people smelt the money, came in, drove the lower caste people off the ponds, and these people lost their livelihoods. Now, that, if you're lower caste in India, that's kind of like what happens to you. That's what being lower caste is about. So most people just accepted this. 12 young men stood up and protested and were beaten up by thugs hired by the new pond owners. When they were beaten up, the communities rose in solidarity, said you can't treat our young men like that. And that social movement was born, got very noisy. If it had just been lower caste fishing communities protesting, probably nothing would have happened, but they were lucky. There was a guy in the area who was a Brahmin, so the other end of the caste spectrum, who just retired from the Indian civil service and set up an NGI, a non-governmental individual. Okay. These are people you meet as you travel around. They're usually very well dressed, and they usually have a briefcase, and in the briefcase is a project. Okay, so this NGI guy spotted and was actually very sympathetic. He wasn't a complete bastard, you know. He was sympathetic to their struggle, and because he was Brahmin, he could open doors for them. So he got them in to talk to the police chief, who'd never taken a meeting before, and the police ended up taking a lawsuit against the landlords who'd beaten them up. He got them in to talk to the state fisheries minister, who ended up drafting a legislation on if you form a cooperative, you have the right to the pond. When I got there in 2006, there were about 100 ponds back under community control. It was one of those fantastic good news stories which come along all too seldom. And I did what any good aid professional does when you have a good news story like that, which is get all the details and never go back. Okay? Because if you go back, someone will have stolen the money, or it turns out you completely misunderstood the first time and actually it's a disaster. You know, whatever. So I just kept my nice little story. And actually, it got me, it got me on the route which ended up in the book. And so last year, I thought, okay, I've got to go back. I'll take the risk. So I went back, and the changes in the intervening 10 years were really interesting. So the Brahmin was no longer required. He came with us just because he fancied a trip. He came with us to visit the communities, but the communities now have 250,000 people organized. Okay, this is India. Numbers are big. 250,000 people organized. That means they have enough votes that the politicians say, overlook the caste issue and talk to them directly. So that's changed. That's interesting. Something happened in a meeting about this size with a mixed audience, mixed group, which has never happened to me before or since at Oxfam. In the middle of a conversation, I suddenly just heard myself blurt out, excuse me, could the women please be quiet? I want to hear what the men think. Right? Which, in India, in a lower caste community, is astonishing. So there's been some big shift in gender norms and gender attitudes there. And surprise, surprise, the women run lakes and ponds are the most productive. And also, interestingly, get the most protection from the police because they're worried about people attacking the women. So a combination of old and new produces some very good results for the women fishing families. But not everything had changed. So we were with this Brahmin guy sort of sitting like this. And while we were talking, every now and then someone would come up and touch his feet out of respect. So it's really interesting that, social norms take a long time to change. And despite this extraordinary process, they were still so deeply rooted that people still said, you're a Brahmin, I want to touch your feet. So just a really interesting, and the kind of things that emerged out of that were importance of technology shift, that original thing about the fish eggs, the importance of conflict and struggle, sometimes in a positive way. Very difficult for Oxfam, set up by Quakers, pacifist to the bone, to ever accept that violence could be a good thing, but it clearly is a trigger for change in some situations. The importance of alliances with unusual suspects, the fishing communities, the alliance with the NGI Brahmin. So and so just lots of things sort of flowed from that. And that's basically the book. So if you want to leave and get some lunch. But I'll sort of flesh it out a bit, I think. So the book starts in an unusual place, a bit conceptual for the average NGO book, which is power and systems. Because I think we need to start in a different place to end up with more interesting ideas. And so I sort of went back to thinking about how does systems work and how does power work and what does that mean in terms of those trying to bring about change. So the first point I want to start with is power. This is, for people who don't recognise it, this is from The Matrix. All the cultural references in the book are from the time when my children were still talking to me. So it's like The Matrix, Harry Potter, The Wire, and then it just stops because then the kids grew up and realised I wasn't that interesting and stopped talking to me. But anyway, The Matrix, there's a moment in The Matrix, the first film, please avoid the other two, where Neo, the Christ figure, suddenly sees the Matrix, the ones and zeros that underlie reality, and he becomes invincible. And I started to think that power was a bit like the matrix of social change. That once you start to make power visible, see how power flows between groups, between individuals, see what triggers this redistribution of power, you start to think about change and activism in a different way. So let me talk to you a little bit about becoming like Neo. Well, not quite, but... A colleague of mine at Oxfam, Jo Rowlands, wrote a brilliant book 20 years ago now on women's empowerment in Honduras. And she said, well, look, power is this vague thing. How do we unpack it? And she came up with this rather nice system building on some work by Stephen Luke, saying, well, actually, the first thing that happens is power within. It's the moment when people say, I've got rights. They shouldn't treat me like that. They've no right to beat me up. They've no right to take my legs, whatever it is. And they get a sense of dignity and agency. And that's often the thing that is overlooked, and it's often the most important thing in a process of social change. Once people have those kind of light bulb moments, which may be moments or maybe long drawn out experiences, they look around and they find people in similar situations and they start to organise. And then it gets interesting. So we had this project in Nepal, which is a really sweet, nice, inoffensive project, okay? Women's discussion classes. So what we, women were very isolated in Nepal, so what we do, our local NGO partner organised for them to come to a safe space, which was women only, with invited speakers, and they would choose the topics for discussion. And it was just starting to build a bit of a network and a bit of a sort of social support network amongst these women. Within 2 months, the conversation had turned to how do we burn down the liquor stalls and smash up the gambling dens, okay? Because the liquor stalls were selling booze to the men, and the men were getting violent, and then they were spending all the money in the gambling den. So suddenly our partner and our Oxfam staff, who thought we had this nice little project, went into risk management mode, and I think, God, what are we going to do? And I'm still trying to get the Nepal team to tell me what happened. They're very suspicious of why I keep asking. They think I'm some kind of internal sort of investigator. I just want to know. But apparently the police were involved, but it all ended happily. That's all I know at the moment. But I really want to get stuck into the detail on this one. When people have power with, and they start to organise, whether it's in trade unions or women's discussion classes or, you know, fishing communities, then they start to exert power over the formal bit of power, which is what we normally understand as power. So the power to make decisions, allocate resources, change policies. So it's not a sort of it's not a sequence, but it's a way of understanding or thinking about different nature of power. There's lots of different frameworks of power. What I try and do with my colleagues at Oxfam is get them to try lots of different ones and see which one works in any given situation. When it gets to formal and sort of the more formal end of power, we're quite instrumental in how we do it. We've got this thing called power analysis. And this is an example from Tajikistan. So we went to Tajikistan, and we're doing some interesting work on water and sanitation, which are in a dire state in Tajikistan, which is what the sort of the most depressing bit of the extremely depressing ex-Soviet Union. I mean, it's a really depressing place. We'd spent some time in the villages, and then we came back and said, OK, two by two, how much do the different players in the village care about water and sanitation? How much do they care and how influential are they? If they care, but they're very uninfluential, so people with terrible services, for example, then do we need to find the equivalent of the Brahmin? How do we help them get more influence? How do we help them move up there? Is it through organisation? Is it through contacts? Is it through advice? What is it? If they're influential and don't care about water and sanitation, then good academic institutions have a simple solution. Another report should do it, right? So research is going to change the world one abstract at a time. And it occasionally works. It usually doesn't. So you want to think about other tactics as well. So, for example, is it about the messenger rather than the message? Will these people, if they hear it from someone they fear or respect, change their views on water and sanitation? Can you flip the incentive so it's in their interests to think more about water and sanitation? What can you do to get those people over there? So you're getting as many people into the top right-hand corner, and then you can get some interesting coalitions going, and you can get some change processes underway. Now, that looks very reductionist, but we've used it on everything from villages in Tajikistan to global climate change campaigning, arms trade treaty. It's just a useful way to map out who's in the game and what you need to do with the different players in the game. So I think it's quite useful. The other part I wanted to talk about is the system, thinking about systems. There's a wonderful phrase from Donella Meadows, who wrote a book called Thinking in Systems, saying, if you want to influence the system, you have to learn to dance with the system. Obviously, as an Englishman, this goes against every fibre of my being, but I've now absorbed this lesson. I'm not going to demonstrate, but I've absorbed the lesson. And dancing with the system is in stark contrast to what the aid business and actually a lot of activists do, which is they bake cakes. Okay? So to make a cake, you need ingredients, you need a recipe, you need an oven, and you can predictably produce a cake-like object. It may not be as nice as that, but you can say, if I do this, I'll get a cake at the end of it. And when you have a cake, you can say, that's because I followed the recipe and had the right ingredients. That is the project. Okay, the project is so deeply internalized in aid people's thinking. I sometimes say to my colleagues, just imagine there's no projects, and they kind of look completely blank. What would we do all day? But there's a problem with this, because we're applying these linear systems of prediction and attributable change in places like this. Okay, so this is a famous leaked US military PowerPoint. Not a sentence you hear that often, right? And it's from Afghanistan. And the General Petraeus and his team had commissioned a consultant to try and understand who talks to who and who influences who in Afghanistan. So what you've got is a stakeholder map, right? A stakeholder map of Afghanistan, and the arrows are influence, right? When this was leaked, it made it to the Jon Stewart Daily Show, which is as big as you get, really, because everybody laughed at it. And I saw it and thought, wow, that's fantastic. That's a really serious effort to understand a complex system. Now, a complex system has so many connections and so many feedback loops that if you poke it, you cannot predict what will happen. And if change happens, and these systems happen change all the time, you cannot know for sure why. Okay? And that's like life. That's like, yeah. When your child is born, you don't draw up a 20-year log frame of activities and outputs which will produce the perfect individual at the end, unless you're some kind of weird, disturbed tiger mum thing. And if you did, I'm sure the results would be really bad. Okay? What you do is you have feedback loops, you learn, you make mistakes, you learn from those, you learn from the kid, you try and discover how the kid is emerging, and that's how you run in a complex system. But we're going into these systems with projects and with cakes. And I think that leads to all sorts of high levels of stress and high levels of waste in terms of brain power and money. So the book is saying we need a new approach. The way change happens in these complex systems helps chart where the new approach should go. So first of all, change in linear systems is nice and smooth. Change in complex systems tends to come in big spikes when suddenly the glacier melts and there's an enormous flood. Those sort of changes. So critical junctures, large scale, wars, crisis, elections, are key moments of change. And even at a small scale, like in Tikamgarh, that conflict was a tipping point for that community and its organising. So we should be thinking about that in terms of how we prepare to influence change. We should be thinking, if you're a climate change activist, you should be thinking, when's the next flood in Somerset? And how are we going to prepare for that? Because that's going to be when the media are interested, that's going to be when the politicians are interested, that's the critical juncture. And yet whenever there's a flood in Somerset, there's just some people standing behind Chris Gurumurthy on Channel 4 News saying this is climate change. And that's about as good as it gets, right? So you could do much better if you consciously planned as far as you can for these big events. Path dependence. If each place like Afghanistan is the product of its own history, it's a path dependent system, then what's the point of all these good practice guidelines, frameworks, toolkits, which are endlessly proliferating on NGO websites? Do we just chuck them away and start with a blank sheet of paper? Probably not. But we need to think how we adapt what we've learned in one place to be of any use at all in another. And that's a big discussion at the moment in the aid business. I showed this to my favourite guinea pig. I have an activist guinea pig who's my son. My son works for Citizens UK. Okay, he's out there actually doing it. I just talk about it. And he read the book because he's a thinking guinea pig. He said, this is great, but unless you can boil it down into two slides, it will be of no practical use whatsoever to people like me. So I said, but I've just written a whole book saying toolkits are terrible. And so he said, well, fine. But if you want anyone to use the book, you've got to boil it down. So I did a sort of halfway house of the ways we need to think and be and the kind of questions we need to ask, but absolutely no hint of what the answers should be, because the answers will be different in each system and in each context. So the way we need to think, curiosity. If you're in that Afghan system, it's changing all the time. You have to be genuinely interested. And I find a lot of activists are not actually genuinely interested. They want to know enough to design their campaign or design their program, and then it just sort of locks down. The interesting conversations when I travel with Oxfam country offices are usually in the bar or the restaurant with younger local staff. And that's when you actually find out what's happening in the system. So we need to get those conversations into the office because that's the crucial bit. Humility. Okay, so I'm just reading a book by one of the least humble men I've ever come across. His name is Yanis Varoufakis. Quite extraordinary level of humble bragging. Just amazing. This is not the sort of humbled by 500 people coming to him in Barcelona sort of thing that he does. This is evidence-based humility. So if you are in that Afghan system, not only can you not predict the future, you only have the foggiest idea of what's going on right now, and history will be endlessly contested. So you are permanently in a fog, just trying to push back the fog a bit further. That is very difficult when you're an activist, because an activist relies on confidence, assertion. It's often younger people talking to people in power, so you have to really stick it to the man kind of thing. And it's a very difficult form of cognitive dissonance, which I'm increasingly thinking is underlies a lot of the anguish and angst and anxiety in being an activist, is you're basically living two different realities at the same time, and you have to hold those simultaneously. Reflexivity, being conscious of your own power, especially if you're whitey working in development, for example, you just have to sort of have that as a factor in any conversation. And then multiple perspectives. So I worry that activists and the aid business systematically cultivate monoculture. Okay? We like people who think like us, have the same values, all the rest of it. Not only that, they have to have audited accounts, websites, email, and understand weird jargon, which we come up with all the time. By the time you've run those filters, you're talking to, like, you know, 0.1% of humanity. So we've got a monoculture of like-minded people, which is an incredibly fragile system. One of the reasons why I think civil society is under attack in many countries is partly because we've made them look so weird and alien by making them think and talk like us. So I think there's some real issues there about how do we cultivate diversity. And actually the report's really good on saying, well, domestic think tanks in developing countries is one way of increasing diversity of thought and action in different systems. I think that's one way. I mean, faith organisations, informal civil society organisations, all sorts of ways we can do that. Okay. The questions we ask, what kind of change? We talked a lot about policy and practice, but I think Trump and Brexit drove home the importance of underlying social norms. How do we feel about the other? How do we feel about belonging? How do we feel about nation? These kind of issues activists have not been looking at a lot, certainly not in my part of activism. They've been thinking about policies and tax reform and, you know, nice, tangible, short-term things. So how do we do things differently if we're going to think about norms? Precedents, learning from history, learning from success around us, something that activists surprisingly don't do very much. There's a really interesting book called The Power of Positive Deviance, which looks at the positive outliers and what you can learn from them on any given issue. Power, I've talked about. And then the final thing, which is all the rage at the moment, is feedback and course correction. So instead of saying we're going to do this for 3 years, what you do is we say we're going to do this for 3 months, and then we're going to have a stand back, and we're going to see what works and what doesn't. We're going to have good feedback systems in place, and then we're going to course correct and move on. And sorry, funder, you're going to have to accept that, because you really want to us to carry on with something that isn't working. That's the alternative. And that's an interesting conversation at the moment, which we're having with the funders. And to be honest, the funders are ahead of us on a lot of this stuff. Oxfam moans a lot. We have a lot to moan about. We moan about climate change, we moan about poverty, we moan about violence against women. If you stand back and think what's happened since 1945, we've had the age of development. We've had an extraordinary period of human progress on income, literacy, rights. The book argues that we can carry on in that age of development mode, but we have to work differently if we're going to keep moving forward. And that's the kind of nutshell. Thanks.
Thank you, Duncan. I was saying to Duncan just earlier, when I picked up this book, I kind of sighed and went, God, this is going to be really hard work. But actually it wasn't. It was really, it's well written, a bit like your talk, with a lot of humour. And also very clearly, and I think one thing to point out, you use the word activist quite a lot in your presentation. That's, you've used it as a catch-all phrase for anyone that's working in any type of social change or advocacy or innovation, or anyone who just wants to make the world a better place, which is quite a nice way of putting it. So you've talked about your power and systems approach, and that's a kind of a key factor of the book. And what's really nice is that you do say it requires humility, a sense of curiosity, this readiness to engage, but to learn and to adapt. And you say that the activists that you've spoken to actually are very open to this. It's the institutions that find it really difficult to adapt in that way, because of value for money, short-termism, the pressure to get results. And so as I'm interested in how activists or how people can affect change, given that we are seeing a trend towards what we're calling these new power organisations. So away from some of the hierarchical structures that have this command and control, but towards more networked and distributed forms. So think social sharing platforms, Black Lives Matter, the Women's March. And even at the RSA, we can see there's a disconnect between how communities are evolving and the innovation they have, and how public policy is actually struggling to keep up with that. So I've got a couple of questions, which is, how can activists in these new power movements, so Think Women's March, how can they make a difference that's quite substantial over and above just having a great time on the streets and then having to go home?
This is a really difficult one. I wish you could have started with something easier.
Sorry.
No, it's fine. So there's some fantastic work on the history of social protest in Europe by Charles Tilley and Sidney Tarrow. And what they show is that if you look from a distance, you get these spikes of protest like the Women's March, right? So one way of thinking about it is, well, great, get behind the spikes, support the spikes. Then if you look into the movements, what you find is those spikes are made up of coalescing grains. And the grains are longer term. So the grains will be trade unions, women's organisations, all sorts of different bits. And so another option is to say, well, let's look at how those grains coalesce and help them coalesce, but also help them endure during the periods when there isn't a big protest spike. I think, given just how slow it is to get decisions in Oxfam or any large institution, saying, oh, let's go with the spike, is probably just not going to work. And actually what we need to do is get smarter at thinking, how do those grains coalesce? The second point I would say is, when you get the protest, if the protest achieves anything, it then enters into the realm of more formal power. So you've got to bank your protest in the form of gains. And those gains might be legislation, they might be change of policy, they might be new leaders. So at some point, the people who are on the streets are going to end up in the room, and they're going to need some support with that transition. And it's a very tense transition, because people who like being on the streets often don't like people who are in the room, and vice versa. You know, so I've been shouted at by protesters because I was wearing a suit and they just assumed I was a bad guy lots of times. From my point of view, I prefer insider. If you're an insider, having lots of outsiders is great because it increases your leverage. You know, you can say, talk to me, or you have to talk to them. If you're an outsider, insiders are a pain in the ass because they make everything confused. They agree half deals. They muddy the waters. So there's a very sort of asymmetric dynamic as well that you need to manage.
So on that insider point, because the second part of my question is, for many individuals, and I imagine those that are within organisations who are activists like Oxfam, but those that are in governments or local governments or businesses, the kind of entrepreneur type people who do want to push change and who want to push some type of systemic change, what's your advice for them to be able to do that, given that actually the way in which organisations work is not conducive to this methodology that you said, actually, we need to work in a very different way to understand how real change happens and to be able to be reactive enough to it?
This is really interesting. So I've worked with companies, governments, NGOs, social movements. And there's another pattern you observe is that people with really good skills in terms of influencing other organisations, when they're trying to influence their own, just think shouting should do it, right? And so what my advice to sort of would-be change agents in Oxfam is, OK, use your advocacy skills. What's the coalition? Who are the champions? Who are the blockers? How do you neutralise the blockers? How do you win over the people we used to call swingers, but we had to change the word? The people in the middle. How do you empower the champions? What information do they need? What analysis? What messages would work? Then what are the critical junctures in your organisation? Is there going to be a change of leadership? Is there going to be a financial crisis? Is great if you're trying to change the organisation. What is it that you're going to use? And normally, it's amazing that people just don't apply that internally. So that's one thing. The other thing is use outsiders. So is anybody here from Sainsbury's at all? Good. I had a really good conversation with a guy from Sainsbury's. We were working together trying to sort out labour rights in value chain. So this is labour rights on the people who grow the veg for Sainsbury's or make the clothes or whatever. And it was a very sensible conversation. We're all in suits and all the rest of it. And then at the end of it, he came up and said, could Oxfam campaign against Sainsbury's a bit more, please? Sorry? He went, yeah, they're about to cut my budget and it would be very helpful to have some stuff in the stuff in the newspapers. So he got it. He realised as an insider how he could use outsider pressure to achieve his objectives on the inside. So it's thinking like that, thinking politically a lot of the time is great.
Well, that's actually a really good segue to my next question. So the piece of work that we did very much looked at how think tanks as a form of social change agent can affect change in mostly African countries. And I suppose one of the challenges we heard a lot from the think tank partners was that they need to navigate this political terrain to advocate for their ideas, but without being seen as political. And they found that difficult. So I suppose the question I have is, how do you believe that, you know, civil society organisations such as think tanks, but, you know, loads of others, may be more activist in their kind of orientation without undermining their own position as non-partisan organisations?
Welcome to my world. The superficial answer is we are not neutral, but we're impartial. Okay, that's the standard there when someone asks you. And what that means is we're not neutral. We're on the side of people who are excluded, marginalised, poor, brutalised. But we are impartial in that we don't line up with any one political party. And that takes you so far. So then, and I think it's the right approach, but then you organise an event on, you know, marginalisation, and you invite all 10 political parties and one shows up. What do? Not let them in? You know, so it's always going to be messy. But I think, and it's particularly messy when what we're trying to do is push power and decision-making to national staff out of Oxford, which is where Oxfam's based, to country level. And in country level, people are activists. People have opinions. People have passions. And they do stuff. So it's a constant management issue that you don't want to close down all that enthusiasm, but you have to manage the risk. And if I had a perfect recipe for it, I would be much more senior than I am.
Well, it's good to hear that actually it's a similar challenge, even, you know, not just for the kind of think tank world, but I think for any organisation trying to navigate a political terrain, but seen to be neutral, because actually that's how you maintain your impact.
I'm sort of shaped by personal experience, which was in the 80s I was a sandalista, so that's a sandal wearing sandinista. And I, you know, trogged around Nicaragua being right on and all the rest of it, and was an appalling apologist for, as things got worse and worse in Nicaragua, I just kept sticking with it, and I kind of regret that now. So, I mean, because the Sandinistas now are just awful. Well, not the leadership. Grassroots are okay. And so that kind of taught me the dangers of sacrificing impartiality.
That's very interesting. And then my final question before I open up to the floor is, I suppose, a bit of a direct one, which is about the future of organisations like Oxfam. Mm. So there is a growing threat around the world to civil society organisations. Lots of counter-terrorism measures have been implemented by governments to restrict the movement and the work of different NGOs, particularly foreign agents, those that are seen as foreign. And at the same time, there is an energy towards creating a domestic market for funding and for support and for work. What do you think organisations and funders like Oxfam and activists can do to support what will be really a sustainable form of development if we can grow more impact in that market? Yeah, how can you guys help?
I think we declare victory at some point.
We've
got to... I don't think we shut down. I think we shut down bits. So I think at some point we really do have to get out of internal influencing in developing countries when there's no need for us, right? So if, you know, one of the things which really bugs me is that there's no fundraisers without borders. You've got, you know, lawyers without borders, clowns without borders, borders without borders if you're a skateboarder, but there's no fundraisers. There really is. Look it up. But there's no fundraisers without borders, and that would be incredibly useful to help sort of civil society organisations develop local forms of fundraising and stop being dependent on people like us. Would be great. But there will always be stuff which requires global action. So I think that increasingly what we'll end up doing is concentrating on the global collective action problems, the climate changes, the tax evasion, and good. That seems like a very reasonable place to end up. What, yeah, the white men in shorts have already left in many cases, and that's a good thing for many reasons.
We're going to open up to the floor. If you have a question, please put your hand up. So we have two questions. This lady, fourth in.
Yes, my name is Merle, and a comment perhaps. I like your model. From a point of view that it integrates the subjective, it integrates the consciousness, right, the issues of awareness on the part of your target group, the beneficiary group, if you want, the vulnerable in whatever category. But I think that from a donor point of view, we need to look at what happens in the power struggle that takes place in the course of this change dynamic. And we need to look at the backlash. So if we go back to your India example, your very first example, where people were organizing themselves, the counter interests, the middle class who now want the fish, are not going to simply disappear. They're going to continue to attack in various ways those people right at the bottom who are now standing up and organizing. So from a donor point of view, I think it is very important that we look at how do we fund resilience within the group, the vulnerable group, in order to resist the backlash. And this happens very strongly in the case of women's groups in strongly patriarchal society. There is a very strong backlash on the part of the patriarchy and attempts to completely wipe out all resistance. So funding that becomes very important.
Just a quick question. My name is Zoe Arden. So just interested, you were talking about monolithic cultures and NGOs, and we've seen some tragic examples in the last couple of years of what happens when we just talk to people that look like ourselves. And interested in if you've got any examples of where NGOs have successfully managed to bring in that diversity quickly, because it seems that it's something that needs to happen quickly, and NGOs are just becoming bigger and bigger bureaucracies themselves in many instances.
Thanks, Duncan, for that. I've really, really enjoyed your talk, and hopefully the books are well-priced. I'll buy a box. I run a company called Green Banana Marketing. We help NGOs scale up. And your India example made me think of what's a good example of that. And you talked about Sainsbury's. And one of my big heroes, really, is Guy Watson, that set up Riverford. I don't know if you know it. And he was driving up to Sainsbury's with all his goods from Devon. And they cancelled the meeting when they just arrived in London. He thought, sod that, we'll create our own business. Now they deliver, I think, to 100,000 homes, and they talk about pesticide, fair rights, labour rights. And it's a sort of great example of a small thing, like you talked about, making a huge change. But it's my question, I guess, is it's quite difficult to, and you've asked this question, it's quite difficult to mobilise ideas at a small level for all of us. And, you know, we are stuck, even, you know, in this market, with the same structures that are difficult to break out. And I know that's not necessarily a sector we're all in, but if you want to launch something new, the power structures are there that keep the status quo. And basically, if you have an individual leader, and Paul Polman's only the one that I can think of that's similar in a big company, Unilever, that really push forward on more than just the product story. And that's quite difficult to do, and I admire both those people for what they've done. I don't know whether you've got any tips for us leading projects as to how we can take a small gem and create it into something magnificent and powerful.
Okay, so Merle, it was more of a comment, but I think it was a very good comment. Resilience comes partly through power within and power with, but it also can add support. So yeah, how do you help people cope with the backlash? Because there's power is... I don't buy that power is an entirely zero-sum game. So taking power, gaining power doesn't always mean you have to take it from someone else, but it often does to some extent. There'll be some losers, and those losers won't like it. So you have to be prepared for that, and that is absolutely true. You can be prepared legally, you can be prepared socially, you can be prepared physically. How do you do that? It is an important part of risk and staying with the process. It's no good just getting a victory, saying, yeah, we got a victory, and then just abandoning shit, which happens all too often. So I think... yeah, good points there. I'm not going to hold up Oxfam as a brilliant example of diversity. I think we struggle on it. We're based in Oxford, for God's sake. You know, I mean, if you walk into Oxfam House, which is this kind of big mothership, three floors, the activist floor is pretty white, and the fundraising and IT floors are more mixed, and that worries me. Okay. On the other hand, there's some interesting processes going on to reduce the importance of that Oxford problem. One is we're seeding new Oxfams in places like Brazil, South Africa, India, which is really shifting the power dynamic right at the top when the big cheeses get together. Very interesting to watch. And the other one is, as I said earlier, pushing power down to national offices, which are increasingly entirely made up of either nationals or at least southerners, you know, from the global south. And that's changing the dynamics, but it still feels... A friend of mine in the advocacy team once counted the number of head boys and head girls in the advocacy team, and it was distressingly high. Anyway, I'm not a head boy, so I can say that. I think in some ways, so this, will the system resist new ideas, new startups? I think it's clearly the case that the barriers to entry in some ways have got lower, that there's more and more, there's startups happening all the time. Some of them get very big very quickly. So I'm quite optimistic on that. I think there's an enormous amount of hype around things like social enterprise. And social enterprises often struggle to be both. They're either social or they're an enterprise, but not many manage it very well together. I still think trying to influence the big guys like Sainsbury's is not a bad way to go for change agents. You know, I teach at the LSE, every student there wants to set up a social enterprise, right? Okay, good luck. Some of those will succeed, but I actually think you need to change the system that exists as well.
Thank you for your talk. Thanks for writing the book. My name's Ian. I'm with a group called Donkey Engine. And we are trying to apply sort of local economic models that will cross class divisions. In other words, I mean, for instance, if you've spent any time in Wolverhampton, you'll understand immediately why they voted mainly for Brexit. Because we can, for instance, in my local neighbourhood, there's 5 or 6 or 7 fried chicken joints. Now, if I wanted to start a social enterprise fried chicken joint, I could be up and running in no time. But if I wanted to start a social enterprise healthy food cafe, where working class mums would feel able and safe to bring their kids... because there's a class issue even when you walk into a healthy restaurant, it will be very, very difficult. So I'm wondering whether you have looked at ways that we can integrate economic models to drive benefits within our own communities that will not be even benignly hijacked by... us middle class liberals, essentially.
Thank you. I work for an NGO that focuses on making media in the developing world for teenagers with the hope of sort of changing cultural norms and changing how they see the world. And I guess throughout your talk, I was reflecting on the role of culture and the role of kind of media and the arts in being able to create change. So just wondered if you had any reflections on that.
My name's Pete Burden. I work for or work with a tech co-op called Outlandish. So two things, really. One, a little comment. I couldn't help kind of noticing your slide and the cogs, assuming that's your slide. Oh, it's not. It's their slide. So I suppose what it puts me in mind of is a quite mechanistic kind of view, which is exactly the opposite of what I've heard you saying. So that's good to hear. The second thing really was about technology, and you didn't mention technology, so I was interested whether you thought technology has a role to play in change, and if so, what it is.
Great questions. People stay a bit longer. This is fun. Ian, the nutrition question, the Jamie Oliver sort of space. A couple of things there. One is, I think middle class people tend to be a bit over apologetic about being middle class, and actually I think there is a kind of osmosis of norms between classes, and I would say, you know, the anti-slavers were all very, very posh Quakers to begin with, but then it spreads, and I'd say you could probably make the same case for feminism, sort of early feminism. So I think you don't want to get too static about there's the middle class and there's the romantic, wonderful people. First thing. Second thing is that there's some really interesting things, and this in a way comes back to the culture question. Yeah, well, some of the most interesting stuff we're doing on nutrition is using culture rather than more traditional forms. So we've got a thing called Female Food Heroes, a reality TV show in Tanzania where people vote for their favourite woman farmer. Sounds cheesy as hell, been incredibly successful. The agriculture minister watches it, which is pretty disturbing. The woman who wins becomes like goes and opens schools for a year. You know, and this is changing. Previously, people said, "Oh, women don't farm; they just help." Right. So this is trying to change norms around women in agriculture. In Peru, we've done some great work with celebrity chefs, saying actually Peruvian food's pretty good. You don't have to eat burgers, and sort of again changing norms about indigenous foodstuffs. So there's some interesting ways around this using cultural channels. And then the tech thing, I think, yeah, I mentioned tech, but very briefly. I think it's, I suppose I'm fascinated by it. I've got a good friend called Ha-Jun Chang, who's a great Korean economist, who reckons that the biggest blow for women's liberation in Europe was probably the washing machine. And the question there is, was there a kind of amazing band of feminist engineers who came up with the washing machine? Well, probably not, actually. It was an accident that a technological innovation had a massive impact on social and political relationships. And I think that happens a lot. Birth control pill, whatever. So we need to understand technology and its importance. Yeah, everybody's obsessed with mobiles and ICT in the development business, yeah, and everywhere else. The reason why I don't talk about it a lot is it gets so much hype. And that there's a tendency of people to see technology as an alternative to politics. I'm sure your group doesn't, but people who actually understand technology don't do this. But there's a lot of people who think, oh, great, if we can just get everybody a mobile phone, we don't have to worry about all that power and struggle and stuff. Everybody will just be able to sell their camel online and it'll all be great. Yeah. And that I've heard that too often from Tony Blair-esque kind of quarters to want to talk a lot about technology.
Sorry, I'm just thinking about cameras online.
Sorry. I heard this, really.
Anyway. I was working in Niger and offered my brother camels for me. Anyway.
But that was face-to-face, I presume.
Oh, no, that was face-to-face, it wasn't online. I just have a quick comment before I went back up to the floor. I mean, there are two things in your book which, one is amusing and one is quite interesting. One is you say activists just make it up as they go along. And there's a sense in your book that... I think this is why I quite like it. We all search for an answer. And quite often, actually, when speakers come and speak at the RSA, we kind of probe them for an answer. You know, what is the solution to democracy? But your book doesn't offer an answer, and it doesn't do that, and it doesn't on purpose, I think. It offers perhaps just a way of thinking or a way of being. So what is that way of thinking and way of being? Because it's peppered with examples, and you've been able to give us loads of examples. So change is obviously happening. You talk about critical junctures. So at the RSA, we call them social moments, these things that happen which are catalysts for change. And my understanding is that you say, well, activists just prepare for those. You can't predict if they're going to happen. But in a sense, all of our work is about preparing for that. That's what I'm trying to elicit from you. What is it? What is it that we are doing that maybe we don't realise that we're doing or that we should be doing?
So I think activism is halfway between art and science. That's the problem, right? So it's a science in that there are patterns you can recognise. There aren't iron laws, but it's like a soft science. But the art is that you have to have brilliant ideas which people haven't had before. You have to learn from something completely different and adapt it. And the best summary I've ever come across is Louis Pasteur, who, when asked about how he discovered pasteurization, he said, "Fortune favors the prepared mind." Yeah, and that's about. So what the book is trying to say is, how do you prepare to improvise? Yeah, that's because that's what it comes down to in the end. So I'll give you one example. When you tell the stories. Looking back, you can do them as a nice, sort of clear, clinical discussion. So 1970s, an economist called James Tobin proposes this weird little thing called a Tobin tax, a tiny tax on currency transactions. And he said we could raise shed loads of money and it would stop currency speculation. No one takes any notice. We went to lobby Ed Balls in the early days of the Blair administration and he just went, yeah. Then in 2008, 30 years later, after Tobin's done it, there's an enormous financial crisis. Everybody hates the banks. Governments are desperately looking for new sources of revenue. Some inspired activists, without having some big theory of change, thought, I wonder if the Tobin tax would fly again. But it's no good calling it the Tobin tax. Let's call it the Robin Hood tax, right? So they rebrand it. They get Richard Curtis, who is a genius filmmaker, even if he did make Notting Hill, to come and make this hilarious film with Bill Nighy, and it goes viral, and 10 countries in the EU are now negotiating what would be the second ever international tax. Historic moment. If it ever gets through, it's been taking several years of negotiations. Now, that the people who thought of that were not did not have a secret formula, but they had judgment and instinct. And the guy from Oxfam who really ran that show had to do it in spite of Oxfam for 2 years. Oxfam kept trying to say, no, that's not in the plan. Come and do what's in the plan. And then after 2 years, they realised it was going so well. And it was suddenly, look, isn't Oxfam flexible and nimble? And aren't we amazing? And we're riding the tide, you know. So, yeah, I watched that with some scepticism. It was that his genius was that, and it's, you can't legislate for that.
So there's a preparedness, but a sense of entrepreneurial action at the same time.
A bit like the RSA's slogan, interestingly. Fancy that.
We've got a couple more minutes for any final questions. Anything burning? Come on, ask about the election. Yeah, this lady here.
Good afternoon. I'm not going to talk politics. my name is Valerie. Thank you so much, Duncan, for being so enthusiastic and inspiring and full of hope and giving us hope. We need that. yes, my question is around education, because you do teach at LSE and you do engage with academia. And basically, this is about skills, this is about competencies. You know, how do we, you know, you hint at the kind of things that system changes should have, you know, and how do we, perhaps we could think about making our education a little bit better and fit for purpose. And because you are trying to influence change in this direction, I think, I would like to get your hints at how it could be done.
So some of the things, if I ruled the world, right, which is absolutely not the way to proceed with a change strategy, but if I ruled the world on higher education, some things I would change. So one of the most interesting bits that the LSE does is when it talks to students and it says, what do you do when you don't know what you want to do? Right? Which strikes me as the most useful bit of any higher education system. The students who know exactly what they want to do when they leave, they're fine. Right? It's the ones who come out thinking, I don't know. Coping with that, one. Two, far too much theory, not enough practice. I'm designing a master's module based on the book. I'm wondering if the LSE will let me take students on demonstrations and that kind of thing, just to get them to interview people and take part and see what it's like. This is going to be an interesting process. The LSE is quite traditional and stuffy, so we'll see whether they accept that. But they're each going to have to bring a campaign they want to run, and we're going to spend the term working. That's going to be their project, will be their campaign proposal. So just trying to get an amalgam between the really brilliant theory and sort of clarity of what you get at a typical university with a lot more hands-on, the sort of vocational change bit would be great. And we had a fantastic meeting with Open University this week, Oxfam, thinking about whether Oxfam and Open University could set up something like an online academy of change, you know, where people from any country could come and talk to each other if they're working on gender or working on water or whatever it is, and just how do we support that. So there are fantastic possibilities.
And critical thinking?
You get that. That's the one thing the LSE really gives you. So, you know, I have people at SOAS, I have people coming up to me at the end of talk saying, so AIDS not entirely evil then, because they have been taught that AIDS is actually an imperialist trap for 3 years by a bunch of good fading Marxists at the SOAS. So critical thinking, plenty of that. All right. But I think we need more than that.
Okay, we have time for one more question.
Hi there. My name's Sean, and I'm just thinking about how to square some of this with the idea that some of us are trying to do some of these things with taxpayer money. And, you know, does accountability go out the water? Does value, and I don't just mean in the sense of DFID value for money, but how do we talk about these things when, you know, malaria, you know, bed nets are not the sort of impact at the top of the log frame or something like that? How do we talk about accountability, about value, justifying what we do to an increasingly skeptical public?
Fantastic question. Some colleagues at the Institute of Development Studies, anthropologists and social development sort of people, hated this results agenda, which they saw as inherently right-wing, being forced on them. So they organized something which they called the Big Pushback, right? And they got loads of people signed up. They were going to have a big conference. And just at the crucial moment, the ringleader was called into the boss's office. And the boss said, we're just having negotiations with DFID for a £7 million core grant. And when she came out of the office, it was called the big push forward. Right? Which I thought was hilarious as a kind of example of real power in action. More generally, there are sort of these two armies massing in the development business on hilltops, right? On one hilltop, you have the power and systems and big pushback people saying, I spit on your log frame and down with results and we've just got to improvise and surf and woo, right? Off they go. On the other one, you've got the people with all the money, right? The monitoring, evaluation and accountability people are saying, it's not your money, it's the taxpayers' money. What do you think you're doing? And I honestly think that they're both right. And unless these people start counting what counts and measuring this stuff and proving impact, they're never going to get anywhere. So we're doing a really interesting piece of work on women's empowerment, where we just published a paper on it on Oxfam. Have a look if you're interested. Where we think we can actually rigorously measure women's empowerment for about $20,000 per project. And that means you can go out and tell a story with some evidence, right? Because otherwise, how do you know? If you're doing a 20-year norm shift project, how do you know after 2 years whether you're getting a really good 20-year norm shift or you're just wasting a load of money, right? You've got to have some way. And it's one of the real problems. How do you do the early signals of success or failure is a really big challenge, I think. So the smartest people in Oxfam are in this very boring monitoring, evaluation, learning bit. They are terrifying, those people, because they think about this stuff all the time.
But, I mean, it's worth noting that it's very difficult to measure some of the outcomes of the examples that you've given. I mean, if you've managed to do it, find a way to do it for women's empowerment, I mean, I'd love to see it. Because, I mean, we were having conversations yesterday to do with, you know, social enterprise and creating jobs in very difficult environments. And, yes, that's a whole big debate in and of itself.
But the interesting thing, I mean, The aid business has been taken over primarily by the disciplines of economics and medicine, and particular sub-disciplines in economics and medicine, who think you can count stuff. Yeah. And they think you can count stuff very, very rigorously. So the RCT, the randomised controlled trials, which are basically like drug trials applied to, you know, women's empowerment, that's very limited. And once we get out of the aid world and start talking to foreign ministries, you know, other ministries, then you can actually have that conversation much more easily. So in some ways, it's particularly bad in the aid business, I think.
Sadly, that is all that we have time for. That was fun, right? We should have continued. I'd like to really thank you for coming and joining us this afternoon. Please put your hands together and thank Duncan Green for coming.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, therSA.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.